UK Wine Show, show number 193 for the 6th of February 2010. Jamie Hutchinson from The Sampler. G'day, my name's Chris Scott and welcome to this week's UK Wine Show. This week we're talking with Jamie Hutchinson from the recently opened but highly successful shop, The Sampler, in North London. In the spotlight we look at our wine poll. Do you believe that wine in moderation is healthier than other alcoholic drinks? And the usual news and tips and tricks. Well, I've spent most of this week helping out the local community painting. 3 nights I've been up to 2 a.m. with a roller in hand and paint on my face. But all done, and now I can just relax and wonder why my body is aching. A big thanks to Fabio in Brazil and David L, who contacted me regarding problems with our RSS feed. It looks like at some point my feed stopped working for new subscribers, and if you were trying to get maybe some of the older shows, it wasn't coming through properly. It was all about an extra comma and a date in the RSS feed, so I'm not quite sure why it suddenly stopped working. It used to work fine for me and we didn't change any code, but all of a sudden iTunes coughed up and a few of the other RSS readers coughed up as well. So if you've had any problems or you want to download historical shows, you may want to just reload the shows from scratch. Just delete them and then reload them. Either way, it's fixed now and it seems to be working fine. So cheers very much to Fabio and David. One problem I don't need to solve this week is our mystery producer. As usual, I'm going to give you 2 sets of clues, the first now and the next one after the news before the interview, and I want to see if you can work out who the producer is. It is a bit of a toughie, but they are very famous for their region. Here's the clue. Our mystery producer is a top producer in Châteauneuf-du-Pape in southern Rhône, growing all 13 grape varieties authorised by the appellation. 3/4 of the wine is produced in AOC Châteauneuf-du-Pape, and 1/4 is AOC Côtes du Rhône. The family were living in Courthézon in the middle of the 16th century, and in 1549 they bought a barn with its plot of land at Cordelette. Later, the manor house that is still there today was built, and it's still possible to see the coat of arms sculpted in the stone walls in the drawing room. Have a think about that. I'm going to give you the second clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Scotland's oldest wine merchant, Cockburns of Leith, has fallen victim to the recession, having traded for over 200 years through 2 world wars and the Great Depression of the 1930s. The wine merchant was established in 1796 by Richard Cockburn, who came from the same family as the founder of Cockburns Port. Cockburns is said to have been hit by a substantial drop in orders from the major banks, but has also been squeezed by competition from the supermarkets. Administrators Ernst & Young extended the deadline for bids to buy the merchant, saying they had had plenty of interest from potential suitors.
It's a shame they didn't make it, but this isn't the first time. Last time a management buyout had saved them. But this time, according to the BBC News, Cockburn's brand name, customer list and some debts and part of the stock have been sold to Livingston-based Edinburgh Wine Importers. That company was founded in 1975 and has been owned for the past 4 years by Sir David Murray, the chairman of Murray International Holdings. Speaking of liquidation, Diageo is liquidating its Bordeaux in the US. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, UK drinks giant Diageo has dealt a blow to the US market for Bordeaux wine by pulling out its subsidiary, Chateau & Estate Wines, known as DC&E, who are the biggest US buyer of Bordeaux fine wine. The move ends a 35-year-old relationship and has left a huge inventory of stock, which is now being sold off at 40 to 60% discount. Some vintners have taken the unprecedented step of buying back their own wine rather than let it be discounted. And 2 Bordeaux merchants, La Compagnie Medocaine and Joanne Bordeaux, will start trading in the US to fill the distribution gap that DC&E will leave behind, purchasing large quantities of DC&E stock to launch their businesses.
It'll be interesting to see if the cheap prices in the US will force prices down in the UK. According to LiveX, prices are up in January, so it may be that only price rises get translated around the world, not necessarily price decreases. But the dumping of huge amounts of Bordeaux should eventually reach the UK, especially for the expensive and underrated vintages such as 2007. It could take a while for this stock to work through, though. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, Australia's grape crush was down 5.4% in 2008 to 2009, weighing in at 1.7 million tonnes. That's according to data released this week by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. The area of grapevines fell by 157,000 hectares, and the yield dropped to 10.7 tonnes per hectare. The 13 largest winemakers accounted for 73% of the total, and a third was processed in South Australia, accounting for 43% of the national grape crush. Exports of Australian wine were up 5.2% to 752 million litres, and domestic sales increased slightly to 430 million litres. That's it in the news this week, but don't forget to check the stories out at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Looks like the Aussies are starting to get things under control at last, but they've still got a long way to go to get their demand and supply back into balance. This week's Spotlight is also about balance. Well, sort of. It's a poll question from January. And the question was, do you believe that wine in moderation is healthier than other alcoholic drinks? I did say it was sort of about balance. The results were a massive 71% of people think that wine is healthier than beer or spirits. The next group, 22%, think that no, wine is just the same as any other alcoholic drink, such as beers and spirits. 3% think it's less healthy, and 4% admit they have no idea. Now, the healthy components wine has over beer and spirits are all associated with red wines, prosiodines, resveratrol, or just antioxidants. All are associated with dark, tannic red wines. I have a page written up on our website called Wine and Health, and it's on the UK Wine Show page on the left-hand side under Spotlights. So do have a look at that if you want to know more about wine and health. But needless to say, wine is not as healthy as many people think, but in moderation, red wine can help. The result is a strong endorsement for the healthy effects of wine. The actual picture is a bit murkier than the public think. While it is true that some wines have been associated with being healthy, some of the benefits are associated with alcohol itself. As the 16th century Paracelsus, a Swiss physician, is quoted, "Wine is a food, a medicine, and a poison. It's just a question of dosage." Another of my favourite quotes is from geologist Richard Seeley, who was a bit misguided, but I do like the sentiment. He said that, "If no wine is good for you, one glass is better and two is the best, then three must be the same as one, and four glasses the same as being teetotal. I'll drink to that. Cheers." But this is clearly not true. I just like the sentiment. But it does highlight there is clear disagreement on what is a healthy dose for you. For example, Professor Roger Corder from Show 31, the man behind the Wine Diet book, considers the healthy amount of red wine to be about 50% higher than most government guidelines. What appears to be clear, though, is that moderate consumption of red wine is healthier than beer and spirits. So what's your dosage? And if you're getting a bit bored with all this talk about limiting consumption, don't think of it as a limit. I like to consider it more a target. As I said, the healthiest of wine is dark red tannic wines. And this week's mystery producer does make dark red tannic wines. I'm going to give you the next clue in our mystery producer. So here it goes. A mystery company was sold and purchased by Pierre Tramer, and the business passed to his son-in-law, Pierre Perrin, a scientist who greatly increased the vineyard holdings. Since 1978, his grandson, John Pierre, and Francis have run the business. The soils are characteristic round stones called galets, which the Shadow believes make a significant contribution to the quality of the wines through the retention of the daily heat, which is then radiated back to the vines at night. The Chateau grows organically, hand-harvested, and uses traditional methods of fermentation, aging, in oak barrels. And the final big clue is, they are one of Chateau Neuf de Pape's top producers, if not the top producer. Okay, that ends this week's mystery producer. I'm going to give you the answers after the interview, which is coming up next. We're going to be talking with leading retailer in the interview, Jamie Hutchinson from The Sampler in North London. Let's have a listen to what Jamie has to say about retailing wine through a recession. Hi, I'm here with Jamie Hutchinson from The Sampler. How are you, Jamie?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. You're an Irishman, aren't you?
I am, unfortunately. No, I grew up in Ireland, but I came over to England for university and have stayed here ever since. That was probably 15, 16 years ago.
Excellent. The Sampler's, it's quite a highly awarded wine merchant in London now. Yep. How long have you been going for?
Only 3 years. So we started at the end of 2006. And yeah, no, I mean, things have been going really well. So we won lots and lots of awards last year, and may that continue.
Yeah, that's very good. Very good. I saw you guys winning a few awards and I was thinking, gosh, that's incredible. Why are you so good? Modesty.
I think what we do is different from most people. So, you know, when I looked at going into the wine business to begin with, because I was just really an enthusiastic amateur rather than a seasoned pro in the business. But I just thought it was kind of strange how people sell wines based on on their appearance, or based on their price point, or based on their reputation, based on what someone else had to say. Well, actually, in many cases, certainly to my palate, there was a whole load of wines that I enjoyed, maybe, in spite of their labelling or in spite of their price. And so what we were trying to do was to give people the chance to try the wines before making a decision as to what to buy. And that way they'll find wines that are more suited to their palate and probably actually are a bit more interesting as well, because otherwise people tend to go for the safe bet or go for the very, very cheapest option, which is often exactly the very worst wine that you could buy.
Okay. A lot of people do on-site sampling, though. Yeah, it's not. I've been to Majestic stores, and they'll always stick a glass in your hand if you ask them.
Yep.
Or even if you don't.
yeah, but if you think about the way that they do it, it's we use the enomatic system in order to keep the wines fresh to begin with, but also to give a measured sample which we can charge for. We use a smart card system that actually charges for each small tasting sample.
So you're actually charging for your samples?
Yeah. It's not at a kind of an on-trade markup. It's basically the retail price of the bottle divided by the number of samples plus a little bit for wastage, an extra kind of 10% or something for wastage. Mm-hmm. So the idea really is simply to get people trying as many wines as they can, so that they can educate their decision as to what they buy. It's not the same thing if you have to open the whole bottle and get through it in a day, and which would drive you towards having as inexpensive a wine and relatively few choices, mm-hmm. As possible. What we try and do is actually rotate through all of our all of the wines that we stock, so that people get a fair view as to as to what range is available, and they can choose themselves which ones they enjoy rather than me deciding.
I had a look at your range, and you've got wines from, I don't know, it didn't seem too expensive, 5-6 quid, right through to, sort of 2,000 Latour for £850.
Yeah.
Which is quite pricey.
We sell wines right across the spectrum. We actually go beyond that for some of the old wines, and we have a quite a broad selection of aged wines. But again, that's because of using the sampling kind of way of selling, we can actually sell wines that customers would be a bit uncomfortable about buying if they couldn't try them first. If you're going to try a wine from the 60s, which doesn't have a huge number of professional tasting notes on it, how do you know whether it's going to be any good or not? Mm. And actually, a lot of these wines are relatively inexpensive because of that, because other retailers find them hard to sell.
Saw some very old Rioja that you're
testing. I mean, we have, on sampling at the minute, we have a 1952 Rioja Gran Reserva from Barberana, which is a great example of that. It's a wonderful wine. And 52 is a very good vintage, but not all that well known. And so the wine's expensive, but it's not... it's not the price of a fresh growth Bordeaux. It's not as expensive as that Latour 2000. And I think certainly if you're going to drink it today, it will give you a lot more pleasure and is a fifth or a tenth of the price.
So you use this. What did you describe the system as? Enomatic.
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 Yeah. So that's the Italian manufacturer of the tasting machines, and they were. I think it was originally set up in order for the Chianti Classico Consortia to show their Chiantis to tourists when they visited Tuscany.
I've seen it in Monte Giano.
You see it in quite a number of different places. It's been quite successful in Tuscany, usually in that kind of Enoteca kind of style bistros or places like that. And the vast majority of people who've bought the machines use them within restaurants or wine bars, because it enables them to have a much wider choice of wine by their glass. Mm. What's slightly more unusual is to use it in a straightforward retail environment in order to educate to inform the purchase, I suppose. But I think the UK is really well suited to being able to to kind of offer that as a service, because we get great access to wines from all over the world, whereas in Italy, you tend to, as in many wine producing countries, you tend to have a real focus on the wines from the local area. And you know, from my point of view, I find myself a little bit bored after tasting, you know, 15 Chiantis. I kind of wanted to try something else. And it's one of the great advantages of the UK or the US or, you know, places like that, which aren't quite so steeped in their own local culture.
It can be quite good. We used it to rattle through quite a range of Montalcinos when we were in over in Tuscany, and that was quite nice just to see the different styles.
It's brilliant.
It's not that easy, though, to use the system here, because there's some really weird legislation. We remember covering it a wee while ago that the UK's got some quite specific sampling measures.
It's a European law, which is interesting because it should catch everyone in the European Union, but it seems that only the UK are as backward or take the letter of the law to quite the extent that some of the councils have done in terms of thinking about what the required sample sizes are, or the required glass sizes. The real issue is for selling wine by the glass, there are fixed sizes of glass, so 125 or 175. In order for... We sell much smaller samples than that. And we wouldn't want to force people to have an entire glass of the wine.
Yeah, just to get a sample.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
What size do you use?
It's a couple of mouthfuls for exactly the same reason, for this silly... the silly legal reason. I can't actually legally tell you how big they are, because then it would need to be one of those size samples, or I would need to be able to absolutely prove that it is for each individual sample. It is the same size each time. It's a couple of mouthfuls, enough to try the wine.
Is that how you get around it, by not telling people how much they buy?
There are a whole range of hoops that we've had to jump through in order to get what we're doing classed as a tasting event. You know, so that's an exclusion to the Wits and Measures Act. That is one of them, is not to provide a measured sample. If it's a measured sample, it then is within the Wits and Measures Act. And so we cannot legally commit to giving you a measured sample without breaching the laws, which is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, I suppose the intention behind the law was in order to stop pubs or, you know, sharp practice, I suppose, of people shortchanging a glass.
Yeah. Yeah.
Obviously, within this kind of usage, it's just totally irrelevant whether you get, you know, 22 or 28 milliliters. The issue is whether or not it informs your purchase, and whether you feel, if you feel it's too expensive, then you wouldn't come back, or you'd get your money back, and that would be absolutely fine. You know, so it's just been the implementation, I suppose, of those fundamental principles, which has been a little bit more tricky.
So you're in the right side of the law in terms of,
of course,
sampling?
Yeah, no. And we had to spend quite a lot of time before we opened in order to get permission to open in the manner that we have done.
Okay, but suffragists who have a similar system, they only sell by the glass, don't they? They wanted to do sampling, but they couldn't.
Yes, but if you think of the way that suffragists... The Wonder Bar in Selfridges works, it really is a bar, and you can buy wine by the glass, you know, whereas you cannot have a glass of wine at the sampler.
Okay.
The whole purpose of what we're doing is like a tasting event, which is to inform the purchase of the bottle of wine, whereas in a bar environment, it's actually the on-trade consumption of alcohol. And therefore, although the differences may be somewhat subtle when you initially think about it, It is quite different in terms of some of the usages. And so that's why suffragists have found it somewhat more difficult than we have. And in fairness, also because I think the Westminster Training Standards people have been a little bit more retentive, let's say, in terms of their interpretations of the law than we've had here in Islington, who've been very supportive.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. I understand you were saying earlier that the legislation is about to change, or possibly changed, subject to elections and...
Yeah, so Selfridges and ourselves and the Wine and Spirit Trade Association lobbied government over the last 3 years, really, in order to get them to consider changing the way that the Wits and Measures Act is constituted, in order to make sure that this the kind of thing that we are doing and the kind of thing that they're doing in small samples is more straightforward on a legal basis. Because the issue for us is how quickly we can expand. We need to get specific permission for each shop that we open. And so we lobbied for quite a long time, and finally the government announced probably 3 months ago, 4 months ago, that they had agreed to the principle of, in effect, deregulating wine when it's being consumed in less than 75 milliliter glasses. So there are no specified quantities below 75 mils, and the retailer would be free to choose whatever size. And that's great for flights and restaurants, so mm-hmm. you can have small glasses or flights, and it obviously makes it very straightforward for us, and it would mean that Selfridges, quite rightly, should be able to go to, you know, to small samples as well within their bar.
Okay, so it seems like your USP is Enomatic, and it sounds like you're also going to be expanding. So has it been quite successful here?
It's been absolutely brilliant, yeah. So we've been selling a lot of wine. We've been winning a lot of prizes, which has meant that we've got more and more customers. We raised some money last year in order to expand. And so we'll be opening, I hope, at least two shops this year in different areas, still within London. But, you know, then beyond that, who knows, you know, we may open a few more. It'll never be enormous. I don't think we're looking to do 200 stores and try and copy Aldbins or something like that. I see no reason why it couldn't be more applicable on a broader scale than what we have here.
What sort of number are you thinking, 20, 30?
We honestly don't know. So it just depends. There are some diseconomies of scale as you get to be a bigger retailer. So, you know, we focus on wines from the vast majority of wines that we sell are from small growers, which are often quite hard to get. Mm-hmm. You know, even for us to get, never mind for the customer to get. And as you get bigger, you actually, there's a risk that you find that your range suffers if you get too big.
Yeah.
But where that crossing point is, I don't know. You know, I mean, many of the other chains find that at around the sort of 50, 60 store mark that they began to find some diseconomies of scale rather than economies of scale. But that's a long way in the future. I mean, so we just don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. I think one thing which is interesting is I think although the sampling is something that differentiates us on an obvious basis, for us, we think that the reason why we're actually being successful is more on the range that we've got rather than the ability to taste by itself. Because if you actually see on a global basis the number of people who've installed tasting machines or stuff like this, their businesses have not actually been all that successful, because what they've tended to do is they haven't had the passion or the interest or the access to the wines that have backed that up. And so it's become actually a little bit of a sort of a fly-by-night, or, you know, it's been a short-term attractive proposition for the customer. Where we think that the only way that we can do well with allowing customers to taste the wine first is if the wines are fundamentally better than you can get elsewhere. And so we spend nearly all of our time actually buying the wines and finding interesting producers and stuff like that. I think that's actually led to more of our success than just the machines by itself.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so it's a mixture of the classic good wines, good customer service, and you've got an interesting USP that does bring the odd punter in.
Well, yeah, but it's not just bringing the odd punter in. You know, it's actually regular customers. You know, the vast majority of our sales are to people who come in every week or every few weeks.
You are in quite a ritzy end of London, really, isn't it? Well, it's gentrified and
It is. I mean, Islington's an interesting place. It's pretty rich. So the sort of demographics are pretty good, but it's not as high end demographically as many other areas in London. Mm. It's certainly wealthier than most. And I think one good thing about most of the people in Islington is they tend to be quite adventurous or maybe a little bit
quirky as well.
Quirky.
When you walk down the high street, everybody looks quirky.
Yeah. But that's good, you know, and I think for, certainly for wines, you know, it means that people can be a bit more adventurous. You know, the wines that we try and sell have character first and foremost. And that's, you know, people need to be somewhat open-minded to, you know, to be able to buy wines with character. Otherwise, they'll just buy, you know, claret and big, you know, Grand Marc champagne all the time.
How do you find the competition? You've got a couple of Aldbins on either side of you within three or four blocks anyway.
Yeah. We used to have three.
You used to have three Aldbins or three?
Three Aldbins on Upper Street when we opened.
Oh, really?
There's now only two. And there was also two Threshers within a Threshers and a wine rack within a stone's throw. Both of those have now gone.
So you've gone from, what, one, two, three, four, five competitors down to two?
Yeah, although one of the Aldbins became a Nicolas, so it's just swapping its brand. So it was before Nicolas sold the Aldbins brand, they actually rebranded one of the shops down as a Nicolas, down towards Angel. It's funny, though, I don't, you know, it probably is competition to a certain extent with us. But I don't know. We don't. Since the Thresher stores have closed, we haven't seen any marked change in the way that people have bought wine from us. I think we kind of appeal to a slightly different market.
Yeah, so maybe Ogden's have picked up a bit of Thresher's because they.
Yes, I suspect they have.
They've got a similar sort of proposition, whereas your wines are, I wouldn't say necessarily expensive, but you're certainly aiming at more the fine wine end of the market.
Well, I mean, you know, we go down to £6. But we don't sell big brands, you know. So the idea is not to sell
Blossom Hill.
Yeah, you know, I mean, life's too short to sell Blossom Hill. So I'd want to sell wines with fundamental quality, or you know, even a wine like Veuve Clicquot. You know, why would an independent merchant stock Veuve Clicquot? Yeah, you can buy it in a corner store. So if people want to buy Veuve Clicquot, you know, go ahead. You know, I'm sure the corner store can sell it more cheaply than I can.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's I just think that it shows their lack of taste. But there they go.
Okay, so you're not a big fan of stocking likes of Veuve Clicquot, but what sort of champagnes do you stock?
So we don't have any fundamental built-in advantage for champagne because you can't try currently, unfortunately, any of the champagnes on the machines. So the first area that we looked at in terms of direct importing straight from France was grower champagnes.
Mm-hmm.
So we now have probably the largest, or almost definitely the largest selection of grower champagnes in the UK.
When you say grower champagnes, you mean instead of the big houses, independent producers?
Yeah, so independent producers who own their own vineyards and make their own wine. So they don't sell to the Grand Marnier. Marks, and therefore they don't have to support, I suppose, the marketing budget that the Grand Marks have in order to produce that very nice branding. And what you get with the growers is you tend to have better pricing, and you have more characterful, not necessarily better wines, but more characterful and more specific wines, and wines which are probably truer to their terroir, I suppose. And so if you know what you're looking for, or if you're willing to experiment a little bit, you can get wines with much more interest and much better suited to your palate. By looking at a grower champagne than you can by the Grand Marks. Now, some of the Grand Marks, particularly at the top end, are, you know, make very good champagnes, but I think you get more personality for your pound within grower champagnes. So we have more than 60 on the shelves, right?
That's quite a bit, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you found champagne to be popular during the recession, or is it completely dried up?
It still makes up probably 18%, 20% of our sales, and nearly all of that is grower champagnes. So, it hasn't changed that much.
Excellent. And your staff, I met a few of your staff on the way in. Yep. You seem to have, what, 3 people here at the moment?
Yes.
Is that
and
normal?
Another 3 at different tastings across London. We're currently at 8 staff, but we're training up for the next stores. We'll probably be, 12 over the next 3 or 4 months. And they all come from different varied backgrounds. You know, so Sebastian, who joined us, first of all, used to run a number of shops for Nicola in London. But we've got people from importing backgrounds, from agency businesses, from Albins, from Majestic, from really a broad collection of people from different retail and different wine related backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And everyone either has or is studying for their diploma at the WSET.
I suppose because you've got, you said earlier that you cycle through a lot of wines through the tasting machines. Does that mean that your staff get to taste a lot of the wines as
well,
they go
through? It's part of the reason why, you know, I think working for us should be, you know, rewarding for people, particularly in the early stages of their career, because they get to taste, you know, a huge number of wines and right up the quality level. And it's kind of some of the wines that we put onto our Icon tasting machine, we have seasoned professionals who come in to taste those wines because they can't generally afford to open a bottle of, you know, Petrus 78 or Lafite 82. And giving everyone in the shop the ability to taste those wines and gain, you know, build some experience is great because it helps them. It makes that, you know, it's an interesting thing to do in the first place, and it helps them to be able to sell those wines as opposed to customers.
Have you felt the recession, or hopefully we're out of it now, but last year you're in your second year, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, we continue to grow the whole way through, but, you know, we're a young business, so you'd maybe expect us to continue to grow. So we didn't find any particularly negative impact. We did see sales of very top-end wines taking a real dive.
Sort of what's between the price?
Over £100 a bottle.
Yeah.
Between, say, October, when was it, October 08, and maybe May last year. So that really stopped, didn't just slow down, it just stopped. But since, you know, May, June last year, it's actually picked up, and it's now right back to where it was before that. And that's only a very small part of our business, but it's noticeable, I suppose, which is the biggest difference. One thing which has been really interesting is that our average price per bottle sold hasn't moved by more than 2% any month since we've opened.
What's your average bottle price?
So it's £22.50.
Average bottle price?
Yeah.
Wow.
The average bottle that we stock is about £14.
Yep.
But the average bottle that we sell is about £22.50.
That's a fantastic price.
Yeah, the reason for that is people, when they taste good quality wines, they trade up and they may buy fewer bottles, but they'll buy better quality. It's very difficult if you try a well-picked Plinio Montrachet and a well-picked Plinio Montrachet Premier Cru within £10 a bottle of each other bottle price, it's very hard to pick the village wine. Because generally you get more for your money. And that's really obvious when it's between, I suppose, £8 and £12. You get a massive difference, or £6 and £12. You get a massive difference moving from six to eight, actually, is the biggest jump. But then 8 to 12 is a big jump as well.
Yeah.
So it does decline a little bit as you go up.
But, yeah.
You know, if we allow people to try, eight different Cabernets ranging from £6 to £100, they may think that they're going to buy a wine, looking to buy a wine at £12. Or a couple of bottles of wine at £12, but they may end up buying one at £20, mm-hmm. just because they enjoy it, and that's completely up to them. We'll try and stock wines as well as we can for each price point, but then it's up to customers to decide what they want.
Okay, and what do you see going forward? You've obviously got plans to expand,
yep.
And that's sort of been hampered by the legislation, by the sounds of it. Although,
yeah, not terribly. I mean, the real issue at the minute is getting the, well, which I'm sure is always the issue, is getting the right sites. So we're being quite picky with the sites that we're looking at. And even in this retail recession where you'd expect site acquisition to be much easier than you would usually, it's still the case that the best sites are still quite hard to get. And so we've agreed terms on one site, and we've got another one which we think we'll agree in the next week. But yeah, it's taken us longer than we expected.
Can you tell us the new site that you've agreed terms on?
Yeah, so the one that we've agreed terms on is in South Kensington, just very close to the tube station, but it's quite a big site as well. It's probably three times the size of this one in Islington.
Okay. All right. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
No, thank you.
Cheers very much. The Sampler is an interesting shop, and congratulations to Jamie for doing such a good job. They just announced today that they're going to be offering, for the very first time in the UK, on-premier wines open to the public. Usually we get to try these in March or so, but everybody's going to be able to pop down to the Sampler and have a wee sample. That ends this week's interview. Hopefully on my trip to Hong Kong, New York, Oz and New Zealand, I'm going to be talking to a range of top merchants from around the globe. But next week we're going to find out about the still wines of Portugal and the Douro Valley. I must admit, Portugal still wines have always been a bit of a mystery to me, so I really enjoyed the interview and tasting a large range of Portuguese wines. But how did you get on with our mystery producer? It was Bocastel. Here are the clues again. Bocastel, or Chateau Bocastel, has 100 hectares of vines in Châteauneuf-du-Pape in southern Rhône, growing all 13 varieties of grape authorised by the appellation. 3/4 of the wine is produced for AOC Châteauneuf-du-Pape, known as Château de Bocastel, and 1/4 of it is AOC Côtes du Rhône. The Bocastel family were living in Courthézon in the middle of the 16th century, and in 1549, Nobel Pierre de Bocastel bought a barn with a plat of land on Goulette. Later, the manor house that is still there today was built, and it's still possible to see the arms of Bocastel family sculpted into stone walls in the drawing room. In 1909, Pierre Tremier bought the property and Bocastel passed to his son-in-law, Pierre Perrin, a scientist, who greatly increased the vineyard holdings. Since 1978, his grandson Jean-Pierre and Francis run the business. Bocastel's soils are characterized by round stones called goulets, or pudding stones for the rest of you and me, which the Chateau believes makes a significant contribution to the quality of the wine through the retention of daily heat, which is then radiated back to the vines during the night. The Chateau grows organically, hand-harvest, and uses traditional fermentation and aging in oak barrels. Okay, that pretty much ends this week's podcast, apart from the quote. And this week's quote is from Anonymous. Now, I'm not sure who Anonymous is, but it's a nice quote anyway, so I thought I would include it. Nothing equals the joy of the drinker, except for the joy of the wine being drunk. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.